Ahoy, fellow mansplainers.
And welcome aboard the Joy of Trek, an empathetic podcast exploring the cosmic strings and music boxes of Star Trek.
All of it.
I'm Kaki.
I'm Kay.
And ignoring Troy's suffering is your chief engineer, Greg.
Together, we're on a mission through the two-dimensional universes of Star Trek to find the brain damage in every Betazoid and the excellence in every episode.
Even the sarcastic bartenders.
Because every episode must be someone's favorite, and it might as well be us.
So tender your resignation and join us as we vibrate into
the joy of Trek. We have it. We have another I'm leaving Starfleet.
We really do. This time it's Deanna.
And so, in case you haven't guessed it or hadn't been listening to what we said last episode, we are doing Next Generation Season 4, Episode 10, The Loss.
It first aired on, December 31st, 1990. Wow. I didn't know that Star Trek was on at like, you know, on the stroke of midnight for the end of the year. Oh, interesting. We've got a lot of credits here. Alan J. Adler and Vanessa Green on the writing. Oh, yes. Hilary J. Bader, who was an intern at the time, who contributed the sci-fi plot. And directed by Chip Chalmers. Now, that's a lovely name. With some guest actors, we've got Mary Conard as Allenby, who's taking over navigation. And Kim Braden as Janet Brooks. Now, she's interesting because she was Deanna's patient.
Yes.
Here, and she would later appear in Star Trek Generations, where she played Mrs. Picard.
Oh, okay.
In a film that was directed by her husband, David something.
Oh, nice.
I had it here.
But. And Mary Conard as the new bridge...
Mary Conard as yes.
Right, because I believe this was the first episode that Wesley didn't appear in because he was put on a bus to the Starfleet Academy in the previous episode.
Oh, yes, that's right. He went to a farm upstate.
Yes. Although, of course, he did come back to reprise the role several times.
Oh, wait, I had some trivia here about...
Yeah?
Hey, would you like to really, really dive into some trivia that doesn't have a lot of bearing on the episode, but takes us to some deep places on the internet of the early 2000s? Okay, it's going to start with this. This is the first appearance of Ensign Kellogg, an uncredited background appearance, played by an actress who goes by the name Cameron. That's her professional professional name. She was also Gates McFadden's backup stand-in and photo double, briefly stand-in for Jeri Ryan when she joined the cast of Voyager.
All right.
So she would be around in case she was needed as a backup stand-in, and then she could also like be one of the ensigns in the background.
Useful,
right?
Yeah.
First of her 43 all uncredited appearances.
No,
Cameron is her, is her name. Now, if you look at IMDb today, at the time of recording, you will see that this role, Ensign Kellogg, was actually played by an adult film actress called Krista Lane. Because of an incorrect merging of those two actors, which yours truly has sent in a little comment about. So for a second, I got really like, oh, did an adult film actress actually play an ensign on Star Trek? Well, that would be kind of cool.
But unfortunately, that wasn't the case.
But it's not a complete loss, because in 2003, Cameron did create the burlesque show Cameron's Bump and Grind, where she played the lead actress and show star Crystal Devine, and she reunited with several friends to create this show, including someone she met on the set of The Next Generation called Antonio.
Antonio.
Antonio, yes.
I am Antonio.
And now, we really need to go to archive.org and find Antonio's website from 2000. We're going to a website. I'll show it to you. You can see that this is a beautifully designed website.
Wow.
with a hunky gentleman. All the bits are covered in this particular GIF, but...
You know what they say, it's not what you show, it's what you allude to.
And lewd indeed. So if I have a quick sort of browse through this website, which has a lot of next buttons, it's set up like that.
As was the style at the time.
Yes, very good. Where you see we have potential credit card secured access to various media surrounding Antonio.
Okay.
All of this is on body2000antonio.com, by the way.
Nice URL.
That's a hell of a URL. Please join my exclusive club. Oh, here's a page that requires Java, which I don't have on this tablet, which is unfortunate. But I think the next one is a biography.
Did you accidentally get on an Antonio web ring?
No, this is all still his website.
Oh, okay.
I understand what you're talking about. Webrings, hey, if you're
showing
listening
our
to this,
age here now.
Yeah, sure. Talk to your parents about what a webring is and they'll make it make sense for you. Okay, do you want to hear Antonio's biography?
Yes, please.
By the time he was 17, Antonio was known throughout which city do you think he was known throughout? Antonio.
I'm going to go with
looks like this.
New Orleans?
Yes. Look at this black and white
photo.
That
looks more like New Yorkish or Boston.
Yeah, you want to go for that?
Oh, crikey. No, New Jersey then.
New Jersey? Well, you were a bit closer than you were with New Orleans. It was Hamburg, actually. Germany.
Okay.
As the one to watch, because not only could he move, he also possessed the good looks of a model, which earned him a page in one of Hamburg's newspapers as Man of the Day.
This sounds like someone who wrote his own bio.
It sounds like I'm having like making fun of Antonio. I am not. I celebrate this. I think it's so cool. And as I was reading this, I had a feeling that this is what Loxana's like Tinder profile looked
oh,
like.
That got her hooked up with that guy from
yeah, exactly.
Yeah. With the ambassador or whatever it was.
Yes, Campio.
Yes.
And there's a link to the Bump and Grind burlesque show, which, oh gosh, I hope it was a success.
Oh, yes.
Oh, wow. I actually hadn't been to... Oh, wow, this poster is f***ing cool.
Okay.
Look at that.
Oh, that's a very big cabbage, or what?
It's like a globe or something.
Oh, okay, I couldn't
now
quite
see. Now playing... That's on bumpandgrind, presumably.com, also archived. I'm sorry, I've just completely lost myself in this now.
Yes, clearly.
Oh, there's a button called View the Show. It says it's sexy. Now you can enjoy, only $5.95. You can buy a 7-day membership. Kay, do you have your credit card handy?
I do.
Kay, do you?
Yeah.
Does it work through archive.org, do you think?
I doubt it. Well, anyway, I'll tell you what, we're going to give it a try out, and if it does work, it'll be on our Patreon.
No kidding. I really hope that this was fantastically successful, and also I really hope we don't find out that there was anything like unfortunate or improper about this, because it looks like just a fantastic show.
Chief Engineer Greg here just had to chime in. I left all that in because I just thought it was hilarious. I'm not even sorry here.
So now I'm wondering, it's like, who is the actor with the most uncredited appearances on Star Trek?
Ooh.
That's going to be tricky. I'm not going to ask our chief engineer to work that out, because the nature of being uncredited makes it very difficult to do research on this kind of thing.
Well, actually, one of them could be... Oh, the name escapes me. She also played Lita Alexander, the original telepath of
Babylon 5. Oh, right, yes, her.
Yeah, Patricia Tallman, who was Gates McFadden's primary stand-in.
Okay.
As Beverly. There's a photo of the Generations film we just talked about where they have the ceremony aboard the galleon where Data pushes Beverly off the ship and into the water. Oh, she was, not the stand-in, she was the stunt person.
Oh, okay.
So Patricia Tallman, who is also a gorgeous redhead, but yeah, she was the one who clearly fell off that ship.
Yeah.
With the same expression. But she played Beverly Crusher in more episodes than Gates McFadden.
Oh.
Did, because she'd also be, you know, background stand-in or stunt performer.
Right.
Like, there were episodes that had Beverly Crusher in it that Gates McFadden didn't perform in.
Okay. That's pretty neat, actually.
So Patricia told me, yeah, she might actually, and, you know, she's a stunt performer and a skilled martial artist, I do believe, as well.
I love that scene on the galleon, by the way, especially because at one point you can see a bright orange boy in the background, because apparently they filmed this on the water somewhere.
Oh, right.
It's like, why would that be on the holodeck?
Not a boy that is a juvenile male, but a boy that shows the ships where to sail. Okay, now I apologize for this long, long divergence, which is actually not totally inappropriate. It's almost like you got caught in a two-dimensional stream of, you know, desire toward a particular goal, and you were dragged along despite your attempts to fly free.
Okay, well...
Shall we dive into the episode? You have?
Well, encountering a migrating herd of two-dimensional beings, the Enterprise gets caught in their wake, and Counselor Deanna Troi loses her ability to sense other beings. The crew must fight and recover the ship from this wake before it gets sucked into a two-dimensional string. Space string? I don't know what they call it.
Strings are not generally two-dimensional, but fine.
Well, string theory was, I think, just getting hold around that time, late 80s.
Look, as Miles O'Brien would later say, when Deanna Troi compared the quantum filament that they were encountering to the cosmic string that they encountered here, they're completely different phenomena. Totally unrelated. Cosmic string and string theory. Oh, I say that. I have no idea.
Yes.
I'm sorry. There's an overload.
Yeah.
They do a controlled warp core overload, which isn't the same.
Which is not a breach.
But the main thrust of the episode is that it turns out that due to this contact, her senses are overloaded, but nobody knows that at the time. And we watch someone deal with a sudden loss of a sense, deal with a newly introduced disability.
Yeah. That's pretty much what the episode is about, and the rest is just a pretense for this to happen.
I thought that as well, you know, in preparation for the episode, and then I watched it, and I actually really dug the sort of sci-fi subplot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, unlike the episode with Roxana and Alexander. Chief, which one was that again?
That episode was Cost of Living, Season 5, Episode 20.
Thank you, where the sci-fi wibbly-wobbly bibbly subplot was completely, like, unimportant. That was
night trial eating.
Yeah. I didn't care then, and I don't care now. But this one was actually, like, this was good and Star Trek-y.
Yes.
Where, ultimately, the resolution was understanding.
Ultimately, the resolution was kind of confusing the migrating creatures long enough so their wake field would disrupt and they could get away. There's little in the way of understanding. It's only after Deanna got her senses back that we realized what was going on.
Well, I'll argue about that when we get there. But do you have any warp cores to breach?
One.
All right.
I say we eject the warp core.
There is a bit of kerfuffle about the detecting of the creatures.
Uh-huh. Well,
it starts with Worf briefly seeing some sort of sensor flash, and then they get caught in the wake. And then only after they launch a probe, they get to see that there's actually a field of aliens after Data has the... He adds virtual particle trajectory.
Sure.
I'm wondering, are we talking about virtual particles or virtual trajectories?
Okay, let's hand this one over to...
But that's not the warp core. That's not the
warp core. Because I'm sure if we ask the Chief, he'll tell us everything about virtual particles or virtual trajectories.
I thought you might know because of your ray tracing background. But
virtual particles does sound like something that exists.
Yeah, but anyway, then there's the whole thing about how they didn't manage to detect them because two-dimensional. Right?
Yeah, yes.
And only when they get the probe out, then they can see them because they're looking at them from a different angle. So, for a start, okay, it's possible that they happen to be approaching them at exactly the right angle, that they were two-dimensionally flat in them.
Yes.
But surely all the ship sensors are not on the same plane. So, since the top of there's quite a difference between the top and the bottom of the Enterprise, so none of the sensors would be... Unless they're exactly coplanar with the two-dimensional beings, they would always have an angle on them.
Well, let's see. If we were the Starship Enterprise, and we were to be dropped into, say, Saturn's rings,
yes,
would you be able to visually identify that you're in the rings?
Yes. Because the rings are only like 50 meters wide and the Enterprise is much more from top to bottom.
Is that difference enough? You know, as in, because when you're standing on the top, it's a vast, vast field. Like, your angle toward the horizon, how far can you see? Would you be able to see enough density, right? Would you be able to get high enough to get that light reflected? It could be tricky. I was also immediately reminded of a lyric from Josephine and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoats.
Yes.
Life is slowly ebbing from us. Hope's almost gone. It's getting very hard to see us from sideways on. Because those are starving and they're very hungry, those poor brothers.
Yeah, yeah. Oh. That's about as bad as it gets.
That's a scientific nitpick, though.
True.
Yeah, it's not a fundamental. Like, I don't know if I can reject a warp core breach, but I think that should be like a little plasma vent that you should have let
go. Very good.
Like, a more substantial warp core breach would be, for instance, if we had like fundamental problems with the way that a trauma response or disability was treated in this episode, which I don't think is the case.
No, absolutely not.
I think neither of us have been unfortunate enough to truly experience this for ourselves.
Well, maybe we should split it up between warp core breaches and technical... No, technical briefings wouldn't be the right one.
Oh, I like where your head's at.
But
this is really good.
We need to find a good name for this. Like, you know...
I'd love to ask the listeners, but then we'd have to wait 8 weeks to hear their responses and then start doing it. And then another 8 weeks we'd get the... So we've got to figure out something. Like, the warp core breach, I kind of like because it's such peril. Plasma venting.
Yeah, but it should be more like a technical discussion or a technical bulletin.
We'll think of something.
Yes.
I'm sure we'll think of something. And this was recommended to us by Leslie. Thank you for the recommendation that we totally didn't forget to record when we were doing the intro and have now sort of snuck in here in media res.
Making a lot of more extra work for our chief engineer, but we know that he's up to it.
Yeah, it's fine. It didn't just cause a big problem at all. No one's in danger here.
Warning, Warp core collapse in 10 seconds.
Will you get that under control, please? Come on. We're all good here, guys. Don't worry about this.
We have a lot of
faith. He hasn't missed an hour of work, and he
has... Oh, good grief. They haven't heard that bit yet.
Okay. And Leslie says, I'm thrilled that y'all are doing this podcast. Oh, I like that she uses y'all. Sorry, not to interrupt somebody else's speech, which I've been told I really ought not to. I'm trying to get better about. But y'all is something that, you know, the English language really, really needs. Star Trek was my first fandom, says Leslie. I'm a big fan of your Star Wars Rebels podcast with Greg, A. Shout out to Rebel Air. And your Farscape podcast with K. So Farscape, thank you for joining the extended cockyverse of podcasts there, Leslie. And she says,
Deanna Troi is my favorite TNG character because she's a senior British officer, counselor to the captain's ship, has a special ability, loves chocolate, is gorgeous, and she's in an on-again, off-again relationship with First Officer Will Riker. She's a likable, strong female character in a male-dominated universe, at least at that time in Star Trek.
Yep.
I like this episode because it gives us insight into Troi's job as a counselor to the ship's personnel. It's a day-in-the-life episode. I also like that we see Troi working with Data, who could be considered opposites in that Troi has all the feelings and Data has none. However, it always felt a bit unsatisfactory because the solution that Troi and Data work out turns out to be wrong. So that seems to be telling us that Troi, without her empathic power, is useless in saving the Enterprise, even if her skills as a therapist do help her patient.
Oh. Oof. Well, having just seen this episode, not to sort of correct someone on their opinions, but I disagree with the assertion that their solution is wrong. Because what they work out in the end is that the two-dimensional creatures that they're stuck in, Deanna infers that they are driven by instinct, and much like many animals are unfortunately attracted to danger because it resembles something that they want. Moths to a flame, she says, moths navigate by the moon and by stars. And when an artificial light, like a flame, shows up, that throws their navigation into chaos and horses running into burning barns. So she's assuming that these creatures are instinctually driven and unable to detect the danger that they're in.
Yes.
But that's just an error in, like, inferring the motivation.
Turns out that, yes, that's exactly where they want it to be.
Yeah, but the inference that they're driven by instinct does provide the solution for, like, regardless whether they're going there by mistake or because they want to, the solution is to...
Set up an echo of the string and thereby confuse them for long enough to stop their progress, break down so the wakeform collapses and they can get out.
Yeah, exactly. And that's completely correct. So the solution that she and Data come up with, even though the motivation turns out to be incorrect, because it's hard to know the motivation of another creature, but the insight is very good. I also like that Leslie points out the sort of combination between Troi and Data, because as this is an episode about loss of a sense, it occurred to me, like, why isn't she having conversations with Geordi?
Oh, yes. Geordi,
who I believe was born blind, but he's lived in a sighted world this whole time.
Yes.
And he might be able to give some insight, like, how do you deal with sort of living with a disability? But that doesn't really apply because...
Yeah, well, I think that was more a little bit handled in her pairing her with Data because...
Exactly.
She and Data lacks human empathy and...
Yes.
More instinct than empathy. Empathy he develops over the series, but human instinct he doesn't have.
Yeah. So she feels diminished because she used to have her empathic abilities and now they're gone and now she's just left with human intuition.
Mm.
And then she deals with someone who has never had either and does just fine.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for that, Leslie. And if you want to submit an episode for our consideration, you can do so at joyoftrek.com/links. You'll find a link there to the letter of recommendation. And what we're really looking for is personal perspectives. Why do you love this particular episode, whichever one it is, more than most people? What makes your love of it? Because we know which ones are good and we know why they're good. But what do you see in it? And also, if you have a recommendation for episodes outside of the Rick Berman era, you know, the Next Generation, DS9, Voyager, and a little bit of Enterprise, they're pretty overrepresented. So we're really interested in some other perspectives as well. Are we ready to dive into the episode now?
I think we are.
So Picard's space wife is going for therapy.
Yes.
Space-time wife, as she appears in The Nexus. And I thought her performance throughout this was brilliant. We see her three times.
Yes. Her breakdown at the end of the first scene, I wasn't entirely convinced with, but right up until that moment, I was totally on board.
Yep.
It's been 5 months since Mark's accident. I haven't missed a single hour of my duties. I volunteered for extra time in the nursery. My language studies are better than they've ever been.
Diana's sitting there going like, yeah.
Yeah, no.
She's not having any of it.
Recovery from a great loss involves a great deal of pain. If we try to avoid that pain, we can make it harder on ourselves in the long run.
And she says, well, I guess maybe for other people, but not for me, because I'm fine.
But she admits that she was very much not fine, that she dreamt about her husband, and that when she said, oh, finally, this nonsense is all over, and then when she woke up, it finally came crashing down on her that he was gone. And,
yeah.
I looked around for anything that belonged to him. Anything. I forgot that after the funeral, I told him to take it all away. What in the world was I thinking?
But fortunately, Diana has managed to keep a music box to the side. I mean, I guess this is pretty much probably when her husband died, Diana was probably just kind of hovering around and like checking for exactly this kind of thing happening.
You know?
And it's just making sure that like, yeah, okay, this like, You see the movers walking out with all this stuff, and she goes like, "Yeah, I'll just take that. That'll come in handy later."
Because they're therapeutic, essentially like programs for oft recurring traumas and experiences. That yes, everybody's response is different. Everybody's experiences are different, but like a lot of things respond to similar treatments, much like in medicine. So you might as well,
yeah,
might as well try those.
How did you know?
Which is at the same time that the Enterprise is being captured by the wake field of these two-dimensional beings.
Oh, interesting. Data does notice that
an aggregate field of plane polarized objects has just appeared and disappeared.
Yeah, they are aware that it's plane polarized, so okay, this must have been guessable. But maybe they were still busy thinking about how Picard wanted to take Riker on a little pony tour of the Himalayas.
Yeah, they want to go for a little ride around the foot of Mount Everest or somewhere, I don't know where, but
I think my horsemanship is a little rusty for the Himalayas, but thanks anyway.
Nonsense. We program an appropriately docile steed.
Javelin.
Which, right. I wonder if that's like Riker's nickname in bed.
Wow.
Ensign Brooks takes her leave in this really very nicely lit hallway.
Okay, yeah. I mean, it's just the same hallway as always, isn't it?
Oh, you mentioned that you weren't really, like, sold on her emotional breakdown toward the end of that counselling scene.
Yeah, well, I mean,
it was a beautifully framed, like, moment of comfort and intimacy, like the hug that Diana was providing. I did quickly look up, like, whether that's maybe conflicting with the boundaries of what's generally considered good therapeutic practice.
Oh, yes, well, there's like a few of those boundaries are being crossed in this episode.
This is actually valid.
Yeah.
This is like, it's up to the therapeutic practitioner,
mm-hmm.
their preference.
How much physical contact they wish to initiate.
If there's clearly a need, it's up to them to decide if they want to fulfill that.
Yeah.
It can also come into, you know, it can also be quite difficult when the refusal to give a hug might damage the relationship. Which,
oh, yes. Know,
this reminds me of a little bit of headcanon that I developed with some people on Twitter. And it was about, I tried to find some kind of more positive perspective on Diana's very revealing outfits, which were, Gene Roddenberry loved sexy women in revealing outfits. Initially, she was going to have three breasts in an early design. Those were the times. But if we assume that it wasn't, you know, the lecherous male gaze of mid-80s television executives, what could it be? Well, I was thinking, one of the things we know about Betazoid culture is the value of nudity.
Yes, although that's only ever expressed in marriage ceremonies that we're aware of, at least.
Exactly. But so, like, extrapolating from that, maybe nudity is a very common, like, a way to express honesty and sincerity and to put people at ease. It's something that they find very comforting when people are nude together.
Mm, okay, yeah.
So and she, that, like, medical practitioners or therapists
right.
might...
Yeah, yeah. So she, dresses somewhat more revealingly than would otherwise be...
Because that's culturally appropriate. How a Betazoid practices psychiatric care. I thought the scene of Diana sort of clutching her head and collapsing was really very difficult to watch because she's not doing the thing that you ought to do when you're suddenly overcome with pain, which is to tell someone about it.
Yeah, well, she does eventually.
Well, the first thing she does is dismiss the one person who's standing right there
yes.
who could have helped her and then leave
clutch
the public
temples,
space.
Yes, slump over her bed, fall down.
Make sure the door is closed so that absolutely no one can see and then lose consciousness.
Yes.
Oh. I mean, I criticize this, but, you know, we've all been in similar situations where we do foolish things like that out of shame or, you know, instinctual response. And now the ship is stuck and she's unconscious and we go to credits.
They don't know that the ship's stuck yet at this point because there's a little exchange between Data and Riker about how long it's going to take them to get back on course with the delay that they've now had.
A resumption of our present course at warp 6 will place us in the Talib Beta system in 6 days, 13 hours, 47 minutes. What, no seconds?
And that's what I'm saying, like Data's learning. Right. He goes like, I can give you the seconds though. No, that's fine.
He anticipated their impatience, but yes. I'll go back to the other thing that you clearly
save
were annoyed
so,
by.
Save so much time if we don't mention that. Deanna does in fact actually call the medical staff, or specifically Beverly.
Yes, who like, has her hands full.
Yeah, she doesn't call the general hotline. No, she dials the personal cell phone of the chief.
Good point. Huh. Everybody else just gets to call sick bay or the doctor's assistant. But yeah, Beverly is a little bit, she's got her hands full with numerous reports of minor injuries throughout the ship, and she'll
be there straight away.
So go somewhere quiet and just die in a corner, Deanna.
Oh, maybe she's a cat.
Just make sure that, yeah, exactly. Make sure that you're the least possible inconvenience to anyone around you, and I promise I'll get to you.
I'm not sure what happened. Lie down, breathe deeply, and stay calm. I'm getting calls from all over the ship. I'll be there as quickly as I can.
They try to warp out. It fails. Warp bubble collapses immediately. They try to impulse out. It fails. The impulse engines aren't impulsing, even though everything seems to be working fine. And if they'd sticken them to fool the impulse so hard, they're going to damage the ship. Yep. So they're stuck.
I do like how it's approached. You know, turn the ship 90 degrees. But, of course, they're still in the same plane.
Yeah. Even I mean, that is the kind of thing that you're supposed to do when you get in the sea and you get tucked at the beach and you get caught by the undertow. There's no swimming against it. You're not going to do that. So what you do is you start swimming parallel to the beach until you're out of the undertow.
Oh, like so.
And then once you're out of the undertow, you can start swimming back to the beach.
Oh, no, absolutely fair. I was just thinking, what about the Z axis or the Y axis?
Oh, yes, well.
Right, what about up?
Yeah.
Did you try up?
They're thinking in two dimensions, Captain.
No, everyone always does, don't they? Oh, yes, to your earlier comment, like, what an awful coincidence that they just happen to arrive in the same plane as this two-dimensional species. Have you seen Star Trek? Ships always arrive in the same plane, like, regardless where they're coming from. They're always arrive. All solar systems also?
They actually stop doing that in later episodes. Then you can occasionally see them at different angles to each other.
Yes, that's true. Very famously in the introduction of Kronos 1 Gorkon ship in The Undiscovered Country comes in at an angle, which I later saw interpreted as an act of diplomacy, that is the Klingon ship that adjusts to the Enterprise's plane.
Oh.
Right? As a sign of courtesy. Oh, yes.
Yeah, you could have set your ship's clock to the...
to the time of Capital City.
It'd be only polite.
Beverly is unable to detect anything.
Yeah.
Well, when I first called you, I was feeling intense pain. Now it's gone, but I'm feeling a bit foggy.
But I do want you to come in for a test, but that test is interrupted.
All senior staff report to the observation lounge.
And here begins Deanna with denial.
Ah, yes.
I found this on Memory Alpha. I can't claim credit for having seen this myself. I don't know where Memory Alpha cribbed it from either, or whether it was a contribution from one of the writers there, from one of the website contributors there. But it charts Deanna's five stages of grief throughout this episode, which are pretty brilliantly written, I think.
Yeah.
So we start with a lot of denial, which is the common first stage.
I may be perfectly fine tomorrow. And you may not.
There are several scenes where you see her like resisting the increasing probability, and she creates... And she's very reasonable about it, but that's...
Well,
that's
until she goes off the rails unreasonable. But
well, that's a...
Anger.
That's, yes. Yeah, that's also a natural response to grief and terror.
Reach out a helping hand to the blind woman.
I'm sorry if I
will not be treated that way.
Hey.
The crew are gathered together. As you mentioned very correctly, they don't really know that they're stuck yet, but there's a sort of general powwow about this situation where we are now.
And then it starts like, oh, can you sense any aliens out there? No.
No. There's nothing. Nothing. I sense nothing.
Data goes off on one, like, well, there are many aliens who are not, can't be empathically sensed, and then...
Yeah, like the Ferengi and the Breen, for the first time.
And then she's like, no, I don't sense anybody.
Great close-up she gets here.
Yeah.
Beautifully lit, and she's... Oh, Marina Sirtis is a fantastic performer.
Now we're in back in sick bay. More scans have been done. There is brain damage.
Just a pattern of unresponsive neural cells throughout the cerebellum and cerebral cortex.
Unresponsive?
There's brain damage. How serious? I can't tell yet.
I think this is going to make a really good chief that's going to get some use here as well. It's like it's just Beverly going like, there's brain damage. It's
like, she's even got a, wow, there's a little smirk at the end. Yeah. Why does she does a little, what's she do? There's brain damage. Womp, womp. Why does she do that smirk?
I have no idea, but...
What would cause something like this? Because it started at the same time that we encountered the anomaly.
There may be a connection, I don't know.
Oh, yes, he's showing concern for the ship's counselor. Although he later refers to her... What's that thing again?
Imzadi.
That's the one, yes.
Yeah, a betazoid word.
Yeah. What does it mean? X?
Oh, no, it's like lover. It's it's a degree of intimacy, but it's unique to betazoid.
It was the on-again phase then, I guess.
Yep. Later in Star Trek Picard, she would say to Riker, oh, I wish I taught you a different word. And the example that she gives is, Chief, what was that?
Yintaru.
Thank you. And Riker asks, what does that mean? And she says,
baby of immense size.
Wow.
But here, again, denial. She says, well, it may be temporary, it may be unrelated, I may be perfectly fine tomorrow. Yeah. Let's just move ahead. Which is also like self-protection. Right. This is probably also advice that she might give someone to prevent them from spiraling into doubt about something.
Going into a panic loop over something that might be inconsequential. So, yes, I mean, at first, that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Nope.
So it's like, well, you know, who knows, it might blow over. Yeah?
And sometimes, you know, that happens, but doctors generally don't love that. I mean,
no, because it highlights their own powerlessness.
Well, yeah, no, that's true. It kind of depends on the symptoms. Like, you know, I'm thinking of TIAs, right?
Oh, yes.
Like strokes that aren't strokes that you recover from on their own. Doctors love those because they mean there's something wrong that we need to detect and prevent. And
yes.
We can prevent tremendous harm.
Cue Dr. Phlox with his,
with his obsession. Apothecary of wonders. Ooh, Diana, into my imaginarium.
Diana retreats to her quarters and starts working on the records for the people that she has appointments with, but Will barges in and comes to check up on her.
Yeah, because she left the doctor's office very curtly.
Thank you, Beverly. Well?
He knows that something is up with her, despite not having those abilities. He doesn't confront her in front of Beverly, with whom she has a different relationship.
But this is where she already starts getting off on him. It's like, oh, I've seen this so many times. People immediately start pitying on you and walking on eggshells and starting to treat you differently.
When he hasn't done anything.
No.
He's just coming in,
showing concern. I'm here for you if you want to talk. Yeah, he's not offered anything like that. But even that is apparently enough for her to start commenting on that.
Which is kind of great because she does want to talk. And the things that she wants to say are shitty. She wants to make somebody else hurt.
I mean, you could say, I'm not saying that's what's happening here, but it could be that, you know, normally she would be able to sense his intent.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Good point.
And now she is just like, because she is going blind, she's like, a lot of the things that she would normally rely on in talking to someone, she can't.
Right.
And therefore, she becomes less... Yeah.
She becomes more like, paranoid is a strong word, but can project her fears onto someone because she doesn't get the reassurance that she'd normally get from feeling his concern.
And I had something written down about that later on as well when she is talking to Picard about resigning. And I'm just like sitting there like, okay, well, maybe you can re-qualify as a counselor because she still had the entire education. But again, it's like, having a cheat sheet the entire time round. Like, it doesn't mean she can't function as a counselor, but it'd be good to do a little recertification because, like, you know, it's when you go through your exams, and I mean, it's not a technical profession, it's more of a soft science in that regard. But it's not, but yeah, I can imagine that, like, an engineer who has a special ability that allows him to see warp fields would need to recertify on warp engine tuning after he lost that sense, you know, because he's been able to do it just by looking at it. And
there's all sort of techniques that you you never really practice because you don't need them because you have a better one.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that could be the case here with her as well. That's why she's like, yeah, she's still a fully qualified counselor. But yeah, a lot of the thing that she's been relying on, especially as we see in the next scene with Janet again, which I'm getting so far ahead of what we're going.
No, I like your tempo. Because
but she's saying the exact same thing. It's like,
Janet says that, oh, I feel like a new woman. I let it all out yesterday and I'm just completely
cried for
over
2 hours.
Now.
Yeah.
And Diana says, hey, full disclosure, I'm not at 100%.
Yeah.
Right? So this therapeutic session is kind of limited by my abilities.
Because I can't tell how you're feeling this morning. But it seems to me that one night of crying can't make up for months of denial.
And Ensign Brooks very firmly says, no, you're wrong. I'm over this.
Yeah.
I feel this completely and truly. And you can't convince me otherwise. And Diana is so defeated.
Yeah, smile and nod, but yeah, she's clearly not particularly happy about that.
I think this is where the sort of bargaining comes in, which is another stage of...
Oh, yeah, it's grief.
Yeah, you know, that also comes up in a very nasty explosion that she has toward Beverly.
If our positions were reversed, I wouldn't have been in here treating skinned elbows while you were lying passed out on your office floor. I'd have been there a lot sooner, perhaps in time, to prevent this from ever happening.
That was so unfair, yeah.
Right? Yeah, completely. Because, like, the bargaining process is, like, imagining that there is a set of rules that you could have navigated around earlier or could navigate around now.
Especially in the light of how that communication between her went. She goes like, oh, I'm not feeling too well. I have a terrible headache. And it's like, she
just
doesn't mention
anything.
Just go
in a corner and die quietly, Deanna. I'll be there when I've, finished watching Gilmore Girls or whatever was on at the time. This feels to Diana like a failure because I think, like, she does already have what is continually racistly called here human intuition.
Yes.
Right? No, it's a sentient intuition. She's making an inference. She's just not used to being able to trust those inferences because they can be wrong, right? And her empathic senses are not wrong because that's a sense that's true if you interpret it correctly. And that's why she feels like at the end of this session, she's pretty sure that Ensign Brooks is full of shit. But she can't confront her with
it. Yes, because...
And so I'm a bad counsellor. God, yeah, exacerbated when they go through new briefing. Data gets to do, like, some kids' parlour magic by showing the graphic of this field that we're in. And see, now you see it.
And now you don't.
Now you don't. And now you see it again. And it takes so long. I actually kind of want to see an edit of this scene where he just goes back and forth. And it's just a 15-minute scene where everybody keeps going, yeah. And it just shows it one more time. No responses, but just...
Maybe that can be your deleted scene.
A little premature, yeah.
Deanna definitely goes off on a little tiff when someone says...
It's a shame we can't tell if they're sentient.
Which she takes very personal, even though it was just an off-the-cuff remark.
Again, doing that same thing that you mentioned. Yeah. Like, she can't tell his intent, so she's projecting. I can very much relate to what she's doing here. She's just holding it together until the end of the meeting because she wants out of there.
Oh, yes.
And as soon as the bell is rung, she's gone. This looks to me like an anxiety attack.
Yeah.
Best idea for now is to try a controlled overload of the warp drive. Jump directly to warp 6.
It's not really made clear what it is.
Overload of the warp core in order to jump straight to warp 6.
I guess it's just like, you know,
do not pass go.
Open all the valves at once. Don't ramp it up, but immediately go for warp 6 or something like that. You
yikes.
Know? Yeah, buffer the warp nacelles and then vent the plasma conduits when they reach too high capacity and then dump all the power into the warp core at warp 6 levels in one go. That sounds like a controlled overload.
I like where your head's at.
Can I go be a technobabble writer for Star Trek now?
I thought the technobabble was really good in this episode. They had a lot of fun words, like an aggregate plane, a plane polarized. Like, oh, those are some fun words. Geordi got to do some fun words as well, although he got to mostly just do some looking at things.
Yes.
While the music told us what to feel. Most of the talking in those scenes was done by the new ensign, Allenby.
But yes, this is where Diana talks to Beverly about that she doesn't think that she can do her job. Beverly tries to placate her with saying, like, well, you're still the fully trained counselor.
How do you people live like this?
And that's when she accuses her of that she should have been there quicker.
Yep. That's anger and bargaining, and they're both completely natural, and they're very unfortunate responses, and it sucks to have to deal with someone going through, and we always feel very guilty when we've been through them ourselves, but yeah, we struggle to integrate a reality that we absolutely don't want.
Then she goes to Picard to resign. I'm leaving Starfleet.
Should we do this?
What the hell is this?
It's almost his response. Yeah.
Well, I love how he just kind of like sighs and puts his hands up to his head and goes, oh, this again.
Another one? This. He says, oh, here's a fun one.
Yeah.
I've been fortunate to have access to your Betazoid abilities. Most starship captains have to be content with a human counselor.
Yeah, again, bam.
Suggesting like, that, wow, humans are overrepresented in Starfleet.
That too, yeah.
She very correctly put him in his place. And I think that this is why our beloved chief opened with the script with Ahoy Fellow Mansplainers. Because in his clumsy attempt to offer some comfort, Picard says...
They say when one loses a sense, the other senses become stronger to compensate. A blind man develops better hearing.
Wouldn't that be a you mansplainer then?
Oh, nice! And she points out, yeah, no, hold on. All due respect... Shit, yeah. You're a tough, you complete lunatic in your grotesquely ugly freak to boot.
Spare me the platitude, spare me the pep talk.
With all due respect, Captain, you don't know what you're talking about. That is a common belief with no scientific basis. No doubt created by normal people who felt uncomfortable around the disabled.
You know what? Oof. That's not completely untrue, is it?
I guess not. The... intent that she attributes to it is maybe a rather uncharitable, but
I think it's honestly it's valid. I think that's something that he hasn't considered. I mean, he's not very experienced with empathy and transporting himself into somebody else's really subjective reality. He's a, you know, he's a great orator. He's a great lawyer,
diplomat
also, but you know, empathetic he is not.
Mm.
It just fucking sucks. I mean, okay, we're here in a group with various minor disabilities. I don't have the ability to see depth due to how my eyes are positioned. Chief, would you like to share yours?
Yeah, mine's fairly minor, but I'm decently colorblind. It's beyond just kind of colors. It also gets into shades. So like reds and oranges can look the same to me, but then reds and greens can look the same to me. Blues and purples can look the same to me. It really just depends on the lighting, the specific shade, how it's oriented. If there's a space between them, I can usually tell them apart pretty decently, but if they're side by side, they're identical to me usually, or it's close enough where it's very difficult. Actually, just looking in front of me, there's a purple thing that I know is purple, but then I have a blue thing right next to me, and the shaded part, it looks a lot more purple, but then the part in the sun looks a lot more like... So it's fairly minor, but it's an inconvenience, and it gets in the way sometimes when I'm trying to identify specific things or figure out what goes with certain things in a complementary way for dressing or for costuming purposes. It gets annoying when I'm saying, oh yeah, and that's that color, and I have a room full of people saying, no, you're wrong, and you should feel bad because you're wrong, or playing the, well, what color is this game? Which gets very old very quickly, but fairly minor as far as like quote-unquote disabilities go. I wouldn't really consider that one myself because I know it's minor. It doesn't impact me in any great way.
Thank you. Do you have any that you want to talk about?
Nothing that would actually rate on the scale of some orthopedic issues, but I wouldn't say like they're more inconvenience. They wouldn't rate on the disability scale. You know,
no, but like a disability is a spectrum, and she does at one point use the term normal people, which is... you know, loaded, but also like suggest that there's a norm. So there are things that other people can do that you can't. And this is very, very common.
The term cis wasn't particularly in the common parlance back in the late 80s.
Cis bodied versus trans, but what are we talking about now?
Well, as in normal.
Oh, in terms of health, like there is a norm.
Fair, yeah.
I mean, so how many eyes does the average human have?
Less than two.
Slightly less than two. Yeah. Because there are none with three eyes to draw the average up.
Yes.
But there's a certain like expected norm of mobility that those of us whose bodies conform to that norm never think about. And so we call it normal.
Yes. Also, women on average have more than two kidneys in their body.
Let's say uterus havers.
Fair enough. Right? Yeah, yeah, okay, yes.
That if you have a uterus, that having a uterus actually multiplies the numbers of kidneys that you have on average.
Yes.
But then again, like on average, like last year, Beyonce and I had 35 Grammy nominations. And this year, on average, we have 37. So like we're both doing really great in our music careers, aren't we?
Deanna's back in her quarters and Will comes by. And at this time, she actually lets him in a little bit.
He does the same thing.
Yeah.
He walks in, but this time, like, he imposes himself.
I really would rather be alone right now.
Too bad.
Because he knows that that's not true. All he does is be there, and she can now let it out. This is grief starting.
She still tries to, like, chide him a little bit. It's like, is this how you deal with all the personal issues that you have?
Shield him with humor.
Yes.
And he responds.
Sure. You'd be surprised how far a hug goes with Geordi or Worf.
And now it's his turn to also be honest. And he's pretty firm with her, which I'm not sure is advised, but of course he knows her very well, that he says that what she lost, in his view, was not the best part of her.
Mm.
He felt that it always gave her an advantage. Now, of course, that's among humans. You don't know what it's like on Beta Zed, where everyone can do this.
Yeah.
You know, you see her mother not speaking to her. They speak telepathically rather than verbally.
Yeah.
Which Deanna considers rude. But yeah.
Well, it's rude to do it in the presence of people who aren't in on it, which implies that it's kind of more of a generic conversation thing and not a direct point-to-point thing.
Oh, as in if you had like 8 Betazoids in a room, they'd all be able to hear each other telepathically?
That's interesting. That seems like an implication of that. I have no idea if that's canonical or not. But the whole fact...
I like that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's sort of, you know, like when we're in Anglophone company and you and I speak Dutch with one another. Well,
yeah.
If everybody else doesn't speak Dutch, then now we have rudely seized some privacy. But
yes.
We don't know if somebody else actually does understand or, you know, cousin language. Maybe they're...
I have that at work.
I've got
quite a few colleagues from outside the Netherlands. And there are several of them that I know understand Dutch a lot better and even speak it a lot better than they let on to. So it's like...
Another one of those superpowers. It's almost like they have Betazoid gifts that they don't let anyone in on.
Yes.
But yeah, he goes a bit far and he says,
I'd always thought there was something a little too aristocratic about your Betazoid heritage, as if your human side wasn't quite good enough for you.
That isn't true.
Isn't it?
Which is very confrontational.
Yeah.
But I think that's what he really thinks. And he's just being super honest with her in a way that that he normally wouldn't. That's a degree of trust. And, you know, maybe his opinion is just kind of shitty, but he's just sharing it.
The little heart-to-heart is interrupted, though, because they're ready to make another attempt at... Oh, yeah, this is the controlled overload.
Yep.
So, saved by the bell, Riker tells him that he's on the way to the bridge. And I'll be there to check in on you later. It's like, oh, no, you don't have to. No, that wasn't an offer. That was a statement.
And Deanna goes to the bar.
First, we have the failed attempt to escape.
I know. We all know that. Like, I'm losing interest in the side plot again because we know where it's going.
Yeah.
I want to talk about her and Guinan at the bar because I read something that hadn't occurred to me before. At the time, Marina Sirtis wasn't getting a lot of stories to do, right? That was a long-running problem with the character that she played. And then along came the amazing Whoopi Goldberg, who, you know, having grown up with Star Trek, was very keen for a recurring role. And this was a woman, she had like 2 or 3 movies coming out every year.
I love that, like, when she found out about Star Trek that she and how it was running, that she just basically went to her agent and said, like, get me on that show.
Exactly that.
It's like, I want in. Like,
and, like, this was so important to her that she'd make the time for it. She'd, you know, demand that other shooting schedules of cinema films would be interrupted so she could do scenes like these.
Yeah.
But there was some criticism that her role was a bit duplicative, is the term that I saw, of Troy, because she's also a confidant. She's also got that sort of exotic air of mystery.
Right. Well, that kind of gets lampshaded a little bit in this scene. Where they
exactly.
You'd make a good counselor. I think so too. So I'm going to talk to Picard about it.
And she kind of does the same thing at like more successfully than what Beverly was trying to do. It's like trying to tell her, like, yeah, you've got other talents to lean on. It's like you don't have to. Your beta set ability isn't the be all and end all of being a counselor.
And this triggers Deanna's like professional defensiveness, I should say. Where she's like, no, hold on. Being a counselor is a huge responsibility.
Oh, is it? No, I can do that. Better hours, better, nicer office. I'm just like, have you seen your office? You've got the bar. That's the like, best office there is. Like, what are you complaining about?
The best office there is one that people don't just randomly walk into any time of day.
Well, okay. Fair point.
The best office that there is where I can keep my little secret stash of whiskey that other people don't come in and ask to be shared from. The best office is basically my own bar, I guess, is what I'm saying, which... Hey, by the way, we're recording in your best office right now, which you only have to share with a kitty cat. Oh, amazingly.
Don't jinx it.
I know. I just want the people at home to know that she's just having herself a little snooze up in her little cat tree. And she's being a very good girl. I'm very proud of Pip the pod kitty.
She hasn't even tried to like bite any wires yet.
You don't really want to be ship's counselor.
What would make you say that?
I just know you're not serious.
Have I given you any indication that I might not be serious?
And that's actually what Guinan was doing. It was a multi-level strategy.
Yeah.
She wanted to show to Deanna, no, you can infer the information without directly sensing it. You can already do that. That's a very valid lesson to share with her. Oh. I also saw the note that Deanna gets to wear all three of her different colored catsuit uniforms throughout this episode, while Guinan only wears one. Despite the fact that she seems to get a different costume every time that she appears on the show.
Oh, yeah, well, and every time on the show, but not between every scene. I do love her style with hats, though. I mean, Guinan's always got some fantastic headwear.
Oh, she's amazing. Any episode with Guinan in it is just a delight.
Yes. Right, now the cosmic string appears.
Yeah. Oh, no, what a problem. Oh, we're being dragged towards it. I hope we don't crash.
No wider than a proton, but with gravitational fields as powerful as a black hole.
And I'm just like, oh, well, why is it like so obvious why then? But I guess that's the, we're not seeing the string itself. We're seeing the event horizon around it. That
something like that. Maybe virtual particles. See? I don't know. Some kind of, could be anything. Could be subspacey wacy. So with the options dwindling, Mr. Warp
suggests.
Come
the photon torpedoes. Yeah. I say we shoot them with photon torpedoes.
That's an awful long sound effect, isn't it?
And it does absolutely nothing.
And at first they try to sort of mitigate it by, hey, what
shooting
if we...
ahead of them?
Yeah. No, they don't. It's kind of a cool graphic, by the way, this whole plane of little red dots. Okay, and with great gravitas.
I mean, you can clearly see that we are watching the updated version, but the shots of the ship outside are gorgeous. This looks like it's still the original shot. Because you can see it's kind of just overlay of explosions on top of one effect
and
another effect.
Yeah, but we're also supposed to see, this is also like a false color image because those particles are not visible to the naked eye.
Also, why are those photon torpedo explosions not even? Why are they like...
Not even what?
Not even. They're like...
Oh, I can't even.
Yes. Well, are you at odds then?
No, of course, you're absolutely right. They're matter-antimatter explosions. You'd expect them to be perfectly spherical.
As we destroy them to save ourselves.
It is unclear what effect a photon torpedo would have on two-dimensional beings, sir.
Which does exactly as much as firing in front of them does. Still nothing.
Deanna is packing up her office.
Yes.
And Ensign Brooks comes in.
And tells her that, like, she was absolutely right.
You made me realize I was doing exactly the same thing to myself as I was before, trying to hide from the pain. Maybe you couldn't sense what I was feeling, but you helped.
That gives Deanna a much-needed boost in confidence, which is very, like, considerate of Ensign Brooks, because, like, even in the midst of, like... realizing her own grief, she was sensitive to what was going on with Deanna.
Yep.
She understood that this was something that her counselor needed.
Yeah, I mean, she literally says it, even though you couldn't sense what I was feeling, you still helped.
Which is good that she got that little boost of confidence because she's soon summoned to Picard's office where he's playing with one of Kal-El's crystal shards left over from the planet Krypton. Why is he holding this?
I thought it was like more like the dark crystal shard that is...
Oh, yeah. What was that called again? Oh, yeah, just the shard, right?
Yes.
Yeah. That is contemplating the essence because time is running out and so he's just sitting in his office waiting for people to show up.
Even in your current condition, you are the most qualified person aboard this ship to assist. Data is an observation attempting to formulate a strategy. I want you to join him.
I think this is really good management because previously, like, he respected her professional opinion that she wasn't able to perform her function. But now that they're at this moment of crisis... He determines, like, you are the most qualified person on this on this ship. I need you working on this.
Yeah, I need you communicating with them, yeah. And she goes to Data, and they're like, it's technical. Like, are they receiving our signals? And Data's like...
Possibly.
Like, are they reacting to them? No, it doesn't seem like they have higher intelligence.
And yeah, then but just, how would you tell, right?
Yeah. Okay, then, well, if there's no obvious signs that they're intelligent, maybe they're just acting on instinct, and then we get that.
A case of pure stimulus response, driven by instinct, just like the moth to a flame.
Now, here, as Leslie, who recommended this episode to us, was disappointed that their solution turns out to be wrong, and as I mentioned, I don't think it's nearly as wrong as Leslie surmises. Mm. Because, yes, they are attracted to the filament based on instinct. Whether that's correct or incorrect is irrelevant. It's the insight that they're responding out of some kind of built-in need, and we need to manipulate that in order to free ourselves from them. And also the insight that we need to see the world from their perspective instead of ours.
Well, yes, it's hard to do that because they're two-dimensional, so... Yeah.
Well, exactly. Like, does gravity propagate through two-dimensional space the same way it does through three-dimensional space? I mean, even in three
you
dimensions...
You should be able to calculate that, except we don't exactly know what gravity is yet.
Right. Yeah. But, I mean, there is a hypothesis that it's a higher-dimensional phenomenon which would explain why it's so incredibly weak in our universe. Yeah. And most of the energy, you know, compared to the other three fundamental forces.
Well, the current theory seems to be that it's not really a force. It's just like gravity.
Oh, interesting.
Because, like, why doesn't a space station orbit the Earth? It's not because it's moving in a curved line. It's moving in a straight line, except that gravity of the Earth has curved space-time, and therefore it appears as a curved line to us. But it's actually moving straight.
No, hold on. Wait, no, that isn't correct. No, that isn't correct. That's light you're talking about. That's the explanation you give for gravitational lensing.
Yeah, but the gravity is the same thing, whether it works on light or on...
Because light ignores the curvature of space. Objects, matter, obeys the curvature of space. We curve with the space. Space looks straight to us.
Mm-hmm. But it's the same thing. If light,
light looks like it bends around a gravitationally heavy object, but that's because light is going straight and space is compressed around it.
Yes.
But that doesn't apply to like a space station or you and me.
No,
we don't.
It's the opposite. No, we are in agreement, but we're not saying because.
The space station
follows the curvature of space. Therefore, to us it appears like it goes round. There's no force acting on it. That's what I'm trying to say. There's no gravitational force acting on it. It's just forming.
Okay, that isn't true. Yeah. It has angular momentum. If space was curving, you'd have absolutely like no angular momentum, right? Because you'd be standing still or you'd be traveling in a straight line, but you're not, right? I've been frequently admonished for using the term centrifugal or centripetal force incorrectly, so I don't know exactly how to do that. But that certainly does apply. You have angular momentum, which you wouldn't have if you were traveling straight and the space was curving.
Angular momentum is just from a particular observer.
Yes, in a shared reference frame.
Yes.
So our reference frame and that of the space station is the same. We agree on the coordinates of positions in space, and it's making a circular path through that space. Now, that space, those coordinates are also compressed from an objective observer, such as a photon, but we don't have that bird's eye view as material beings.
All right, well, I know how these discussions go. They're usually held at around 11 at night when we both had a drink or two, and they last far longer than we have time for in this podcast.
I know.
So,
suggestion for Greg, just how about you just fade out and then fade us back in when we have a little laugh about, well, I'm glad we got that sorted. I'm sorry for digging in my little heels, but I just really like these conversations.
I'm not conceding anything. I'm just saying,
I'm pretty sure I'm right.
I'm pretty sure we are talking cross purposes here.
Well,
yes,
I'm
pretty sure that what you're saying is correct, and that I'm not explaining what I'm trying to say correctly.
Okay,
but let's get on with it.
This is fun energy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Great. Makes great podcasting.
We've certainly reached the anger phase of dealing with our disability. I really like Deanna's confidence because she does realize the full weight of responsibility that it's on her and Data to do this together. And Data can't make an inference because he doesn't even have, like, intuition. And he's already used his reason and come up with, insufficient data. Insufficient information to draw a rational conclusion. So it's up to her. And she makes I keep using this word, but it's the right one, an inference.
Mm-hmm.
If Counselor Choi's supposition is correct, a replica of the string projected behind the cluster could induce them to reverse course, disrupting the graviton wake long enough for us to escape.
And she stakes her professional reputation on it.
And, in fact, the life of the entire ship, because it's 3 minutes till impact.
I mean, it's not like they had other options.
No.
They're all just sitting there waiting around for someone to have a new
getting
idea.
Getting dragged along, getting closer and closer. Of course, the problem is solved with the main deflector dish.
Oh, they call it the parabolic dish, which presumably is, the main deflector dish to send a simulated pulse. Because, how are we going to simulate an entire cosmic string? We don't need to.
Yeah.
We just need to simulate the effect that it has.
We can't simulate the gravity. We just put out the signal that it gives.
The vibrations. And then you see, this gorgeous close-up of the dish as some in space dubstep drops.
Yeah.
It's chaotic, and they figure out the right harmonic frequency.
With a little bit of tuning of the dish, it becomes a much more palatable sound.
And some of the two-dimensional creatures start pulling away, and that leaves enough space and chaos for the Enterprise to withdraw.
They slow down, which makes that the wake field collapses that was dragging the Enterprise along, and they can warp out of there.
And Deanna briefly has a little... Oh, she has the vapors.
Ah, yes.
Much to the concern of Picard.
Oh, this is the thing. Like, you're sitting in a comfortable chair and you suddenly start feeling a little bit overwhelmed. So now, of course, you stand up. Yes. And then lean on the console that's right in front of you.
Lean on a console that we know has weapons controls on it and just put your open palm on it. Yeah. But she's back. She can feel it again. And what she feels was, hey, no, we were indeed wrong about the motivation.
They're home. We were wrong. The cosmic string was never dangerous to them. It was the one place in the galaxy they most wanted to be.
Maybe they were two-dimensional explorers who used one of these strings to have a poke around in our universe.
Yes.
And have just been looking for their way back. And her whole sort of support crew is with her in the bar in 10 Forward. It's Riker and Beverly and Guinan. And she apologizes to Beverly, who says immediately, apology accepted.
Oh, Beverly.
Apology accepted. Therapists are always the worst patients, except for doctors, of course.
Totally get it. What a friend to have is Beverly.
It's interesting. Like, I wonder why that is. I mean, it's like when I come with an IT problem to another IT-er, then I don't object to the fact that they start with the obvious things first, you know, rather than being
a doctor. Have you tried turning it off and on again?
Rather than being a doctor about it, going like, oh, no, I've done all this, and it's definitely not this, and it's definitely not that, and then you go to them, and you're like, you know, I got this thing, and I don't understand it, and yeah.
All right, let's try turning it off and on again.
Let's start at the basics, yeah.
Do Windows updates.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, really have, you know, look in the task manager, all those that stuff that you normally skip, in case there was something there, because that's where you go to someone for help. But I think there's a difference there, which is that doctors are used to dealing with people who feel powerless, right? And part of the way that they help people is by, you know, I have control over a lot of things.
Right.
I have a lot of knowledge, and I have a lot of ability to choose things.
Yeah.
And then to be powerless while you're supposed to be the one who projects comfort and control makes it also... You're aware that a lot of the times when you're comforting a patient, you're not as confident as you're projecting.
Good
and
point.
So
yeah.
When somebody does that to you, you know, hey, well, oh,
yeah,
wow.
I know where that's coming from. Yeah. Guinan gets a little dig in at Deanna.
Well, you were just being human.
Are you sure that position isn't open yet? I mean, I would like the office and also better hours.
Yeah. Riker gets the last bit of help and support in.
She thanks him.
Yes.
In her, oh, look at this cool jumpsuit that she's wearing. This little teal number. I like that.
But it's also like Riker's. Like, thank you for making me face my other half, she says. And then he says,
frightening, wasn't it?
With the biggest grin on his face. It's like...
Yeah, that's a little bit weird.
Yeah.
But he's very considerate and very, very affectionate. And he leans in for a kiss. And she sort of stops him.
By the way... The next time you call me aristocratic,
I'm gonna cut to the exterior.
Nice little shot of the Enterprise quietly drifting by.
And that's it for the loss.
Yes. All right.
Okay. Now, do you have any
captain's log supplemental?
Yeah. Do you have any supplemental?
Oh, I think like that. Guinan might make a habit of just wandering around through the bar with cups of tea in her hand, looking for people who are in emotional distress.
Now, who am I going to use this on now? It's 4:00.
Yeah.
It's been a few hours.
It's getting a bit cold. I hope there's someone here soon who I can like offer some more tea.
Oh, there's one. I'll just hover on over. Here we go. Oh, I need to get my fix for the day.
Yes. I wonder if she does that to other people in other departments as well. It's like, you know, when there's like warp engineers having a bit of a crisis and she goes like, hey, I hear there's an opening in engineering.
Oh, wow. That's like her one move that she has.
Yeah.
And it never works except now. Yeah, as soon as she walks away at the very end, and it's just her and Riker sitting together, you see in the background her sitting down with a cup of tea to someone else. Yeah, you know, hey, I heard you just quit your job. It's going to take over. It's got better hours. Yeah. Ooh. As for my deleted scene that I imagine was filmed, but not entirely sure. I mean, I suggested that originally Data's show and tell about like looking at cybers. Now you see it, now you don't. Lasted a full 15 minutes before everybody got it. But I'm actually coming down from that. I think that after this, after she's had this conversation with Beverly Guinan and Will, Deanna is summoned to her, it wouldn't be a court martial, it would be a hearing over her OSHA violation. Because when she quit, when she walked to the captain to quit, she starts off by saying,
I've been working with Ensign Brooks since the death of her husband. She's avoided the reality of what happened, denied it to herself.
Immediately breaking, like, counselor-patient confidentiality. For no purpose. Just to put her own point. So, yes, no, Deanna, that recertification that you put in for at Riker's request, you are actually going to have to do that, but this time it'll be remedial.
Yeah.
Privacy is such an important factor. People need to trust you. Yes. Anyway, so that's my little idea.
Okay. In guest case, let's see what we have in stock for next week's episode.
Okay. Our chief engineer has dropped us some clues, so let's see if we recognize these lines and can infer what next week's episode is going to be. Take it away, chief.
Quark says, in this bar, you're not my brother, you're my employee.
Okay. So, Quark. DS9.
Obviously, DS9, yep.
Fruel says, spare me, I'm old, I'm fragile, I'll push the rest of them off myself.
Fruel?
No.
That doesn't sound like a familiar name.
No, unless it's the name of the Grand Nagus, but...
That's Zek.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, number three, let's see.
Kira says, just give me two mugs of Synthale, a double order of Hasbrat, and hold the conversation.
Okay.
Okay, so she's having issues.
A double order of Hasbrat. Ooh, I wonder if it's strong Hasbrat. We have a few more.
Quark says, me, but I'm on your side.
We're not getting...
No.
Anywhere close. One more.
Rom says...
Wait, hold on.
I think it said Rom.
Rom says...
Rom, yeah.
Workers of the world,
you know.
Yes, okay, now we know.
Lose but your chains.
Okay, so it's that episode, but I can't remember.
That episode? Okay, how do you want to describe it? Because I know the name.
Okay, no, it's the one where, like, Rome leads a workers' revolt against, I have no idea, I can't remember much more of what's...
You're completely right. He wasn't just a hero, he was a union man, and it was...
You know what episode this is.
Yes.
This is DS9, Season 4, Episode 16, Bar Association.
Bar Association. It's such a great name.
Well, I mean, is there any lawyering involved?
No, but they work in a bar.
I know, no, I get that.
There's probably like a little bit of sort of legal work there as well. I don't think anybody actually passes the bar, but...
Okay.
So,
well, maybe bars of Latinum get passed.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Well, it's expensive drinks. That having all been said, get it on.
What the hell is this?
I'm leaving Starfleet.
Energize!
We hope you've enjoyed this week's episode with your friends Kay and Kaki. Production and editing by Chief Engineer Greg and music by Fox Amore. Join us next time for DS9 Season 4 Episode 16, Bar Association. Visit joyoftrek.com/links to send us your recommendations, support us on Patreon, or to find us on Twitter. We'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening to The Joy of Trek, and we'll see you out there.